Hello, and welcome to episode 103 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We are here today with Sarah Bloom Raskin, Deputy Secretary of the United States Treasury and former Governor of the Federal Reserve Board. Sarah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
Excellent. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing, or what have you ever done, to advance the public interest, and why?
Well, Jordan, the role of Deputy Secretary of the Treasury is one that is embedded very heavily in the public interest, because what I do as the number two person at Treasury is to orient our policies with our people so that we can produce and operate in a way that is going to work for the American people. And the focus of the Treasury Department, as you might imagine, is a focus that is very broad, but essentially the Treasury, you know, pays the bills. We raise the money for the country in order to do what the country needs done, and we pay the bills. And so operationally, we have a very strong mandate to make sure that we are doing these functions correctly. And at the same time, we have a very sharp eye being given to the economy and how it's looking, particularly how it's looking not just for particular segments, but really for everybody. Mm-hmm. And it's that perspective of looking at the impact of the economy on everybody that is one that I think infuses the public interest and infuses our mission here at Treasury.
So you're interested in making sure that the economy works for everybody.
There you go.
Is there, what's a concrete example of how you've actually been able to do that in your term as at the U.S. Treasury or in the Federal Reserve Board or earlier?
Right. So one thing to keep in mind about the period of time that we're in, and of course the only way to think about doing anything is through understanding where we are in the historical arc here. We have just come through one of the most difficult, challenging, deep, and longest crises, economic crises, that our country experienced since the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. And these crises are not insignificant on the lives of people. People lose homes, they lose jobs, they lose wealth, mm-hmm. And they lose confidence and hope. And one of the overarching missions that we have been focused on here at Treasury is bringing people through this financial crisis, bringing households and businesses through the financial crisis. And the way we do it,
yeah,
to anticipate your next question,
yeah,
is we there are obvious various levers that exist. So we can think about this sort of in the policy wonk world. You have monetary policy levers, mm-hmm. you have fiscal policy levers, and you have structural policy.
And what are the
levers.
Differences?
And the differences are this. Monetary policy is how you affect the economy through the setting of interest rates and the use of monetary policy tools, which are what the Federal Reserve engages in.
When you speak about somebody having their home foreclosed upon, they would be familiar with the effects of monetary policy because they had actually had an interest rate potentially on their mortgage that they would have been struggling to pay, and especially with the variable rate mortgages that led to many foreclosures in the crisis, you actually see a direct impact on the regulatory...
I think that's right. Although what you're talking about is less monetary policy and more regulatory policy or structural policy.
Okay.
So that's really the third bucket of tools mm-hmm. that policymakers have used in terms of responding to the financial crisis and the effect of the crisis on people's lives. There's the monetary policy tool.
Mm-hmm.
There's the fiscal policy tool. Now, the fiscal policy tool is the use of the budget, right? Government spending. Government spending is an important way in which you get money back in the hands of people in terms of doing certain kinds of infrastructure investment. And we saw this, of course, in the early days of the financial crisis when this administration actually, with the help of Congress, passed a fiscal stimulus program.
So when we talk about a budget, just to go back to really what the U.S. Treasury does, you're talking about the United States Congress passing a budget, the president signing it into law, the Internal Revenue Service collecting the money, and then the U.S. Treasury will spend the money as directed by Treasury on parks and roads and bridges and schools and anything, and the military, anything else that Congress says we want to spend money on, the Treasury pays the bills. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. Just to one minor correction is that it's not the Treasury that directs the spending. Congress has set the blueprint for how the spending gets done, and it's then Treasury's role to implement it according to those directions.
Right.
And the other piece too is, yes, the IRS is the mechanism by which revenues are collected. Revenues are also raised. Funds are raised through Treasury markets, right? So in other words, we also raise significant amounts of money
Treasury
that are necessary
bonds.
Through Treasury bonds. Exactly.
Okay, excellent. So there's a lot of very detail-oriented, complicated policy issues, monetary, fiscal, structural, that many of our listeners are probably not too familiar with, and I imagine when you were a teenager, you weren't too familiar with. So at some point, you began this career in finance and in economics. How is it that one, you know, some of our listeners may be young and wondering, well, what am I going to do? How would I ever get to those heights? And you know, when you went to law school, can you talk a little bit about what led you to be here?
Sure. Well, you know, you say like a lot of people, you know, don't really think about economics when they're young. I actually did.
You did?
I actually did. one of the very first books that my father gave me was a book which was really an elementary economics textbook, and it was called Why We Must Choose. And it was all about trade-offs. And as you know, economists are famous in talking about trade-offs, that yes, you can have more guns, but you're going to have less butter.
Yeah. You know,
it's these trade-offs that that the economics methodology.
If you have a dollar to spend, you can spend it on X or Y, but not X and Y.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. But anyway, I did become intrigued about economics fairly young, and I was, you know, and I think a lot of your listeners, if they have the chance to take economics courses in high school, I think it's a fantastic way to start to put your toe into the water of learning about these concepts. But as you noted, I did not become an economist. I actually became a lawyer. And the motivating factor at the time for me was really to think about how I could do something that was bigger than myself, something that could be a way that would have an impact on a lot of people. And I think the study of economics promises that. I think the study of law can promise that as well. And I did go to law school and graduate from law school, and I focused, though, afterwards really on issues of banking and finance. And as I proceeded in my career, wanted to apply those disciplines to what we started to see in the financial crisis. Because, of course, as I started by saying, the financial crisis was a searing experience for many people. In fact, a lot of students who graduated in those years of the recession had an exceedingly hard time landing into jobs. And in fact, they find empirically that people who graduate into recessions actually it takes upwards of 10 years to get yourself back onto the trajectory that you might have been on.
So I know that student debt is an issue of great interest to you, and I want to get to it in a moment. But before we do, you know, many people remember where they were when Kennedy was assassinated. People remember where they were when they heard about the 9/11 attacks. As a person in finance and in the world of economics, do you have a sense of where you were, what you were doing when you found out that the Great Recession was taking place? And for many individuals, there are so many components to it. What was the indicator when you realized, oh my God, this is really happening?
Yes. Oh, it's such a great question, Jordan. So the moment for me came where I was actually able to be in a place where I could focus on it because I was the commissioner of banking regulation, of financial regulation for the state of Maryland. Mm-hmm. And I recall very distinctly sitting in my office in Baltimore when these events started to unfurl. And I recall getting calls from bankers that that things seemed to be happening in a way that they were not fully understanding. But the moment that stands out for me was really the moment in which the former Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, and the former Federal Reserve Governor, Ben Bernanke, together walked to the Hill to make the case that a massive infusion of capital was going to be necessary for our financial institutions. And that moment is a moment that you don't see regularly or typically in the course of
And why not? Why don't they normally go to Congress?
Well, because what they were asking for in this case is they were indicating that the financial system had frozen up, that that there was a massive liquidity crisis. And
for our listeners, liquidity
is essentially money. Money
cash.
Wasn't moving. Cash was not moving between between
lenders
counterparties,
and
between lenders and their lenders, between lenders, borrowers, counterparties. It had essentially, the system had frozen up.
And so when the leaders who had access to different information than the rest of us said, went to Congress to appeal for assistance, you knew, uh-oh, there's a real problem here.
That's exactly right. Now, of course, I had a different perspective prior to this, because you'll remember that I was, at the time, I was in Baltimore, and I was starting to hear that things were not going well. The number of foreclosures, people who were losing their houses or were afraid of losing their houses, we were hearing more. We were getting more calls.
Already Elijah Cummings
already
was holding work seminars on how do you handle a foreclosure in West Baltimore at the same time. So it's
so we were hearing, and you know, and those excellent seminars and workshops that Congressman Cummings had put together were put together as a response to what was happening. And
how did you respond?
And what we saw was, again, we were seeing that calls were coming in, that people were experiencing a level of stress around their homes.
Now, when you say
that, we
stress,
hadn't seen before, right? And so that was, we had early signs, but it was really the moment, you knew that there was a larger crisis at hand, again, when you see the person who holds that monetary policy lever, in other words, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and the person who holds that fiscal policy lever, you know, when we talked earlier about these levers, the Secretary of the Treasury, together making the case that this was an extraordinary moment, something needed to be done, and that something was the request, and this is what became TARP. Right?
Yeah.
This became
Targeted Asset Relief Program.
Exactly. The infusion of massive amounts of capital into what was then the recognition that our financial system did not have the capital that it needed to function.
Is that called Keynesian economics and reminiscent of the New Deal or not?
It is an aspect. I mean, when you think of Keynesian economics, you think more in terms of the pushing demand out into the economy. This was something different, because this had to do with the structure of our financial institutions and whether they had enough capital and what it was going to take to restore confidence so that we could unglue that freeze that had happened.
So just to pivot for a little bit and add a bit of levity to the interview, it seems as though there's some sort of... I wonder if you think that having geographical proximity to the nation's capital results in perhaps greater representation of Marylanders in federal government. The reason I ask this is obviously you have Secretary Tom Perez, Department of Labor, who's a Marylander. You have Steny Hoyer, high-end Democratic leadership in the Congress. Nancy Pelosi was a former speaker, also born in Baltimore, and her family's political there. And then you had Chris Van Hollen in the Congress before he went to the Senate, who is also... Do you think there's a disproportionate influence of Marylanders in federal government?
No, I don't think I've ever really looked at it. I think we have strong public leaders from across our country.
Right.
I mean, there are people who come in from very far distances to Washington to lend a hand and to contribute to, you know, the important work of our democracy.
All right. Well, moving on, back to student debt, as promised. So this has become an issue that is somewhat, how would you describe it, an issue that's close to your heart?
It's definitely an issue close to my heart. It's close to it's close to a lot of what a lot of students are experiencing now. Because of course, you know, in our country that one of the great engines of income mobility is education,
mm-hmm.
and being able to have the opportunity to complete a quality higher education, and we see. Both economic benefits and non-economic benefits that accrue to people who complete a quality four-year education,
mm-hmm.
Higher education, as well as benefits to our country, because when you have an educated workforce, you actually live in a country where you can produce more, you have higher levels of productivity, you have higher levels of economic contribution. This is a real engine to growth. But there's also, of course, the non-pecuniary sides, the fact that you have greater levels of citizenship, greater levels of participation, you have a greater social cohesion. So there are non-pecuniary benefits as well.
Did you have student debt from Amherst or from Harvard?
I actually did,
mm-hmm.
And
how did that hamper or change your decisions in life?
First of all, I was fortunate to be able to not have a lot of it, right? So I was able to pay it off relatively quickly, but that is more a function of, you know, having been born into certain circumstances. There are many, many students out there,
mm-hmm.
Some of whom, their parents have not gone to college, where they are in real need,
mm-hmm.
and we want to be able to provide them the means to be able to go to college and complete a four-year education. And you know that the cost of, you know, tuition has been
skyrocketing.
Yeah, so it's become...
And you have kids in school and college now.
And it's very hard to actually afford a college education. So to be able to do it without any debt is really quite difficult.
And so I'm just wondering how your decisions are informed, how you recognize, how you identify the real stress and the challenges facing our nation's, our nation's students, let's say, who are seeking a higher education. Do you go out in the community? How do you find out what is the right solution, right? You have escalating tuition. You have kids taking debt. Often it's students 18 to 22, but maybe it could be people returning to college in mid-career. How is it that you really understand what the problem is? And then what are some of the solutions? If you just name like one solution that you've done in the course of your time here to really help make life easier for students.
Right. So we look at, and I'll name the one possible solution in a second, but Jordan, what we do is we obviously look at the question from a macro perspective and from a micro perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The macro perspective is we have a lot of data, so we can look essentially at what is happening in terms of levels of debt,
mm-hmm.
that students are
from
are
banks.
On.
How do you have this data?
We have this data because most student loans are federal student loans.
Oh, federal.
So essentially, we can
from the Treasury.
From the Department of Education, we are able to count really the levels of debt. Like we know how much has been taken out. We know what the repayment rates are looking like. We know when students fall into delinquency. We know when they fall into default. So we have macro data. But to your point, how do we know what lies behind the macro data? Well, we take on these micro exercises, right? So we go out into student loan populations. In other words, we go to different schools and we
have you personally gone to a school?
We've done that. This is one of the initiatives that I think has been so illuminating here at Treasury is that we have done a series of student loan roundtables around the country at different kinds of schools, at community colleges, at four-year public institutions, at four-year private institutions, and we've assembled students who have challenges on financing their student loan debt, and we talk to them, and we try to understand how they look at their debt levels, what they understand, what they don't, and then we are able to take those observations back to here to Treasury to analyze and make sure that the policies that we are contemplating are informed by the real world experience.
Now, if any of our listeners have taken statistics, they'll know that just going out and speaking to students at colleges could be anecdotal and not statistically significant. But these stories really humanize the human costs of taking these loans. How do you prevent yourself from being incorrectly influenced by stories which are emotional and make sure that you make decisions driven by data, but at the same time really recognize that these are not just statistics, but these are students who are trying to build lives, and because of this debt they may not get married or have children till later and they postpone life decisions. How do you balance that?
Well, we balance it. That's we stay conscious of it is what we do, right? So you're exactly right that data is extraordinarily important, and you want to make sure your data is sound and that it's comprehensive and that you're looking at the right things. I would say that the anecdotal experiences are just that, but they help us ask the right questions. We then ask ourselves, is the data showing anything? Or is the data hiding things? Is the data, are we collecting what we need to collect in order to make the right decisions? But we constantly toggle, you know, you say it's, you know, maybe between kind of head and heart. I think it's a rigorous process in which we are asking, you know, do we have all the right data? Questions having to do with postponing life decisions. We call that, in economics, we call that like a crowding out effect. You know, does the student loan debt crowd out other kinds of investments, other kinds of decisions? Do people buy fewer homes because they have higher levels of debt? Do they start fewer businesses because they have higher levels of debt?
So
we're able to take these issues of the heart, maybe, and understand them as significant, quantifiable questions that we need to analyze.
So, Sarah, wonderful conversation. As we near the end of the podcast, a final question for you to ask you to reflect on your years of service. Suppose that decades hence you'll be looking back on a career, a lifelong career of public service in many different ways, and you'll be doing next whatever you're doing next, and you've done whatever you've done. What's the point? Why have you been doing all this public service? What's your legacy? What do you hope to leave for the next generation? What do you hope to be remembered by? What is your epitaph? What is Sarah Bloom Raskin for the United States? Who are you, and what have you done, and why?
Oh, what a big, big question. Well, I have to tell you that the opportunity to serve the common good is something that you don't always get the chance to do. And one of the honors to me has been to be able to work with a magnificent group of people, all of whom have come together to want to do something bigger than themselves. And I've done it in an area of specialty to me, which is, of course, the economy, and an area that is that can be complex, in other words, finance. And I have tried with this team of extraordinary civil servants to articulate these complex ideas in such a way that they actually can improve people's lives.
And that has been Sarah Bloom Raskin, Deputy Secretary of the United States Treasury and former Governor of the Federal Reserve Board, who speaks about a lifetime of service as a means of becoming involved in something bigger than herself. She has seen the real human impact of financial and economic policy and has sought through her expertise and knowledge and through her work, she has sought to alleviate real human quotidian concerns such as attending school, being able to get married, the effects money have on real Americans' lives. For Sarah, being able to have an impact on people's lives, as she mentioned, both on a macro level for all 330 million of us, and of course, a disproportionate ripple effects around the world of American financial policy, and also on the micro level when she goes out to universities, she sees students. In her career, she has ultimately chosen to do public service as a means of doing the best she can to make sure that Americans are able to get by. So, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jordan.
And this has been episode 103 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.